Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, I'm here with Sienna Chrisman, a Brooklyn-based writer and researcher who covers agricultural policy and social justice. Sienna, I'm so excited that you're here. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I feel like this is the first time we're meeting, but I think maybe we're kind of kindred spirits in a way, just from reading your writing.
Same.
So we write for some of the same publications. We live in the same place. So I want to talk to you. I invited you on to talk about some of the big economic challenges facing farmers that you've been reporting on. Before we dive into that, why don't you give us a little bit of insight into your background?
Sure, thanks. and thanks again for having me. It's really such a pleasure to meet you and to be here.
Yay.
The thing that I always go back to, I grew up in a town of 350 people in rural western Massachusetts. My parents were part of the Back to the Land movement in the 70s. And we didn't have a farm then. We had a big garden. But I was really raised in this very rural environment. And my dad is from central Illinois. And while I did not enjoy my trips to the Midwest as a kid, and after my grandfather passed away in the early 2000s, I thought, this is great. I don't have to go back to the Midwest anymore. I'm all done with that place. But there was something about my dad grew up in this town that was really thriving when he was there, when he was a kid. And that he had just really seen it die, essentially. Mm. And his sadness about that, I think, really impacted me, as well as some things in my own childhood. I grew up, when I was little, we went to a small dairy farm to get our milk. Mm-hmm. When I was like 8 or 9, the farmer sold his cows. And so there was kind of a visceral level of like understanding of what loss of farm community means,
right?
That I think is a lot of what's really driven my work, like psychologically. I studied at Mount Holyoke College and did a lot of work there, actually, that fed into my current work around like connecting broader trade policies with then the impacts that they have on people's everyday lives. I spent a couple of years in Italy and seeing how different the food culture there is there was really, really impactful at how different that is here. So those are some of the things. And then I spent a number of years, I spent 8 years at Why Hunger, which is a grassroots support organization based in New York. And it was there that I started working with farmers, commodity farmers. Folks growing, mostly living in the Midwest, some in the South, growing corn and soybeans and dairy farming. And it was really, I really saw how a number of things. One, their struggles around like corporate consolidation and how little control they had over their own practices and food production were really similar to a lot of like the urban gardeners that I was working with here in Bed-Stuy or other places in Brooklyn, and that was kind of amazing. And then also really seeing that those stories of those Midwesterners were not being recognized or acknowledged at all by this burgeoning food movement, which 10 years ago. It was just really, they were not the fetishized farmers.
Right.
and they were really demonized in a lot of ways, even though it seemed clear to me that a lot of their struggles really epitomized actually what was going on for many farmers and for food production overall.
Right. And so you have all this experience looking at agriculture and within the food movement, but you don't have a background as a journalist.
No.
No, but that's amazing because you're such an incredible reporter. And one of the things that struck me about your story on Civil Eats, which was called Is the Second Farm Crisis Upon Us? And I encourage people to read it if you go to civileats.com and just search farm crisis or, it'll come right up. One of the things that struck me about that story was that it was really deeply reported and had so many voices of lots of different farmers from across the country, people in rural communities. I guess to start out, to kind of talk about that, so you've been thinking about these issues for a while and the struggles of rural communities in particular and farmers. So what made you say, okay, it's time to write this story? Like, is this the moment where we're in a farm crisis?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. And I guess I'll sort of start with the point about... So I don't have training as a journalist, and thank you for your kind words on my reporting. So I came up through, I've done a lot of advocacy, and I still do a lot of that. I wear one hat as a very part-time independent freelance journalist. Mm. And then I do a number of other things in writing and research. I do some communications work for the National Family Farm Coalition. So I'm still like simultaneously doing advocacy and journalism. And I'm kind of always figuring out like how to do those things simultaneously in a way that's objective and fair. And what is objectivity in journalism anyway?
We could have a really long conversation about that.
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble with a lot of agriculture reporting because of that. Mm. So I've been working with a lot of these farmers for a lot of years. Definitely these commodity farmers, but also a lot of different kinds of farmers through all this advocacy work I've done. And I've been hearing from them the whole time I've been doing this work, how hard things are. Mm. And largely that's been for small scale farmers, certainly dairy farmers, certainly vegetable farmers. But then this year really was becoming clear that also the larger scale grain farmers were facing something new. Mm. And that's been kind of rumored for 2 or 3 years, I'd say. Those conversations have been going on with, do some work with Farm Aid and Food and Water Watch and a lot of community-based farm organizations around the country. And yeah, there's been kind of these rumors. And this year, it was pretty clear that like this was the time that needed to be talked about. Mm. Civil Eats actually approached me about writing something for their rural environment and agriculture project, which was really they're putting dedicated funding into reporting about rural issues this year. And based on my prior reporting with them, I was really pleased to be asked. So we kind of batted around some ideas and. And it just seemed, again, like this was this farm crisis that was happening now for grain farmers was not really, again, something that was on the radar of kind of the food movement and the farmers market farmers or the farmers market aficionados, I guess. In my really early reporting, I was talking with friends and colleagues. I have a lot of folks who really straddle that line. And I was talking with and kind of trying to figure out like what's really the through line of the story that I want to tell here. And I was talking with one friend who's a young vegetable farmer in Iowa, and she has a really great finger on the pulse of kind of what's happening both in vegetables and larger scale. Mm. And I said, are people in your community like the young farmers market farmers, are they talking about a farm crisis? And she said, we know that that's happening out for the grain farmers. We know that that's happening, but people aren't really using that term. But people, she said, people talk about how screwed we all are all the time. And that really resonated. Like, I've been hearing that for years. And I realized it was a chance to tell the story of both what's happening to the grain and dairy farmers, which is kind of more new, but also to shine a light on struggles that many other sectors of the farm economy have been having for years, decades even. And it also really illuminates how fragmented the farm economy has become. And I really found that in my reporting.
Yeah.
Because again, there were some people who would say, like, yeah, we're not feeling this new crisis, because this is not different right now than it has been for 30 years.
And that was more the small family farmers, would you say?
So that was more like the diversified vegetable farmers. Mm-hmm. And the black farmers. But it kind of, I mean, it does depend some. There are like some smaller corn and soybean growers also who've maybe been kind of at the edge for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Things in dairy have been at the edge for a number of years.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always struck. So there's sort of like all these different groups we could talk about. And I mean, in terms of the young farmers, like your friend you were talking about, the thing that I'm always struck by every time I talk to young farmers is how they all have other jobs.
Yeah.
Like basically all of them, if they have, you know, diversified vegetable farms and they're young and they, you know, have started in the last few years, it's almost always true that either they have another job or they have a partner that has another source
and
of income.
I will say that's not just for young farmers market farmers. Mm-hmm. That is for, I can't remember what the statistic is, but like almost all farming families have somebody working off farm. Hmm. You just can't support a farm anymore under current farm policy without an off-farm income, which is crazy.
Right. It's for so many reasons.
Yeah.
And so I want to ask you more about, you said the thing that felt more new was the grain, that like the grain farmers are really struggling now. When in your reporting, what did you find in terms of why that's happening, and what are the, like, those challenges that they're facing? What do they look like?
Yeah, it has to do with the way that prices fluctuate on the global market. I am not an economist at all. But the main thing that I know about it is that overall agriculture prices, the prices that farmers get, that they take home, tend to be, for the last 30 years, tend to be low, often tend to be below the price of their costs of production. So there are some times that those prices go up, that they get, that farmers make more, and that will have to do with ethanol is a big reason that prices have gone up, because it increases the demand for corn. Changes in global markets, if there's more chance for export, prices will go up. And so some of those things had been happening in the past few years, and then a number of factors all kind of converged right now to send the prices back down, which is, again, like their more normal state. Farmers tend to be really optimistic all the time. Mm. And I'm not sure if they always know that farm prices tend to actually, like, the state of farm prices as a norm tends to be low. I think that a lot of optimistic farmers think of, oh, well, this is an abnormality. Surely they, you know, the 3-year period when prices were high, that's what we're going to get back to. And they might, but they might not. Mm-hmm. So prices were going back down anyway, and then this trade war started. In February, prices, USDA was predicting prices this year down, I can't remember now the percentage, a lot from last year. And then the president started this trade war.
Right.
And that is hitting, that's hitting corn and soybean farmers especially really hard. And it hits different pieces of rural economies also. I mean, it's, I think, yes, the trade war is hitting farmers, and also when factors of the trade war hit impact rural economies more broadly, mm-hmm. that all kind of feeds into the larger problems of a farm crisis, right. just in kind of depressing the whole rural economy and community.
Yeah. And then another big part of the story was dairy, which... Yeah. I mean, we haven't even done that many episodes of the Farm Report this season, but I think the challenges dairy farmers are facing has come up at least 3 or 4 times. Everyone's talking about it. And there was one stat in your story that really shocked me about the number of farms just since January, the number of dairy farms that went under in Wisconsin.
It's now 500.
Oh my God. And it was like, it was all, what, 3-something?
380-something when this piece went to print.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's now, the October number was 500.
That's crazy.
So yeah, that's 500 dairy farms in Wisconsin have closed since the beginning of this year.
It's really like hard to wrap your head around And so can you talk a little bit about like the reporting on dairy specifically and some of the stories that you were hearing from people?
Yeah. It's really hard. So I've been doing some kind of informal reporting and research work on dairy for 4 or 5 years. And when I started, prices were like kind of reasonable. They were still below the cost of production, but farmers could make it work with those prices. And since then, since 2015, they have just taken a nosedive. So I can talk a little about why that is and the problems with the dairy pricing and the dairy industry, or I can talk more about some of the stories that I've heard. I could like go on for a full show about dairy.
Maybe let's first talk a little bit about why that is, because okay. I think that would be really helpful.
Great. Yeah. So the way that dairy pricing works is extraordinarily complicated, and I won't really go into that. But
excuse me. It's okay.
But the main issue is that, like with everything, like with all agricultural commodities, the policy that exists for dairy is to produce as much as possible, and then to get whatever price you can get on the market for that. And so what's been happening in the past few years is that an increasing number of... So we still have many small family farms producing milk in, and that's certainly true in New York, in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. But then in the last few years, there's really been increasing investment in enormous mega dairies,
right?
10,000 cow dairies. And these are being opened in places that have no business raising dairy farms, in New Mexico. Dairy takes a tremendous amount of water.
Texas is big too,
Texas,
isn't it?
Yeah. Colorado. I mean, even California. California is the biggest dairy state, and they have water problems.
Yeah.
there's these 10,000, 100,000 cow dairies, and it just that amount of milk just completely saturates the market. Mm-hmm. The government's idea then with what to do with that is, okay, well, now we have too much milk, so we have to figure out what to do with that milk. So much milk then depresses the price for all farmers. Mm-hmm. The mega dairies can absorb the price drops. The small family farms cannot absorb the price drops. Mm. So that kind of, in a nutshell, that's what's been happening. And that's why this whole question of dairy exports has become really important. In this recently agreed new NAFTA deal that was just finalized last week, the new agreement with Canada, that one of the big sticking points for that was holding that up was Canada's so-called protectionist dairy policy. And what that meant is Canada has a very common sense dairy policy that we ought to adopt here called supply management. Mm. And it controls the amount of milk that is produced. So it looks at how much milk Canada drinks and uses and exports, and then that is how much milk the dairy farmers are supposed to produce. Mm. And that means that then they don't overproduce and flood the market and send the prices down. The U.S. feels like that is protectionist, and that we want access. What that means is that some of their market is closed to right. U.S. exports, and we want access to those markets. The problem in that whole narrative, speaking of journalistic objectivity, the one thing that was never brought up in all of those discussions, that I never saw talked about by journalists covering the NAFTA deal, mm-hmm. was Canada's dairy market is smaller than that of Wisconsin. So to like even fully opening their dairy market won't actually make very much difference right. at all. And yet it was really touted as like, this is the thing that we need to solve all of
it. It was, yeah. I mean, I saw a lot of reporting where they were saying this is like, you know, going to make such a difference for dairy farmers.
And a lot of like big dairy organizations are saying now, oh, this is going to fix everything. This is going to solve the crisis. But it's not, because it's not going to take care of, we have a huge glut of milk in this country, mm-hmm. and Canada opening their market a tiny bit is not going to absorb all of that at all.
Right. And I mean, is there a chance it could also then create a globally expanding dairy crisis, and that then their supply management system would be thrown off, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we've been hearing from, Canadian dairy farmers, they are not happy with this at all. Right, and then as their supply management system is chipped away at, then what will happen is that they will be in the same kind of system as we are, for that you just have to produce as much as possible, mm-hmm. leading to even further glut,
right?
And lower prices.
Lower prices. Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's really basic economics. Mm-hmm. That if you produce too much, then the price goes down.
Yeah. And that, you know, I just thought of this, that number in Wisconsin, did you find numbers like that in terms of small dairy farms that were going out of business that applied to like New York and just New England?
'Cause I couldn't find those. Mm. It's clearly also happening in New York.
Which is why I asked, because it's, you know, we've both talked to lots of farmers over here. But I haven't seen those numbers either.
No, yeah. I wonder if it might be that Ag and Markets here, or the other departments of agriculture in other New England and nearby states, maybe just don't keep those numbers in the same way as Wisconsin does. So instead, what we have here is stories like in the spring, when Agrimark, which is the largest dairy co-op in New England, I guess, sent out with their milk check, they sent out suicide hotline information to all of their dairy farmers with their milk checks.
Right.
And that got really mixed reviews. Like, yes, it was great that the co-op was acknowledging the problem, but just providing mental health counseling information doesn't actually fix the problem.
Right. And I mean, I think it's like, I don't want to minimize at all the importance of mental health support services.
Totally.
And there's so, you know, that is so important that farmers have access to support. But I mean, I reported a story earlier this year on the, on suicide among farmers, and the farmers that I talked to, actually, I think one of them was someone that you had in your piece. And when I asked her about those hotline numbers that were, you know, being given out and all these support services, federal policy that was proposed to increase mental health services for farmers, you know, she was like, we don't need a hotline. We need to be paid what the milk is worth. Like, we can't be paid less than the cost of production. It's not gonna help if we can't make ends meet, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's sort of important, but it's not like you said, it's not really solving anything.
Yeah. 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 And actually, to that point, if I can just kind of jump in on a small piece there. So Joe Schroeder, who I led off the piece with and who was kind of one of my main characters, is the farm advocate at FarmAid. Mm-hmm. And he talked a lot about farm advocacy. And the idea of farm advocacy is they talk about it as a three-legged stool, and it's they address mental health issues, legal issues, and financial issues. Mm. And farm advocacy has a long history. It's a discipline, I guess you can call it, that began, was really started by a lot of farm women in the 1980s, during the farm crisis then, who were seeing a lot of the women were the ones who kept the books. And they were seeing, they couldn't figure out what was happening. In the 1980s, there was this foreclosure crisis, and they couldn't figure out what was happening, why their farms were being foreclosed on. And so a lot of them, kind of independently of each other, took it upon themselves to learn farm law, and largely to understand their own situation. And then once word got out that they knew stuff, then other people started calling them, other people whose farms were in foreclosure who needed help. And so some of these women, and it was almost all women, developed these services where they would help farmers work through their legal and financial issues, and also provide mental health counseling services. And sometimes that was like the immediate need. But the people were triggered into emotional crisis because they were having, like, their lives were falling apart for very real reasons.
Yeah.
And there were a number of years when some states actually funded farmer advocate hotlines. Minnesota had a really robust one, Oklahoma also. And they had state funding, and they also had a whole network of volunteers. Mm. In Oklahoma, I think any farmer could be admitted to a state mental hospital for free for a short period to kind of get out of crisis. But the point of the farm advocacy work was not just to address the mental health issues. It was to look at, right, this person is in crisis because their whole life is falling apart and they are losing their livelihood and their land and everything that their family is built for five generations. Of course, they're in crisis. And so, like, helping them work through that as well.
Right, address all of those different components. Yeah.
And that network of farm advocates is just very reduced from what it used to be. It's the shame is that a lot of the funding that there is these days for farmer mental health is really just for mental health. It's not for these other pieces. It's super important, but it makes it less sustainable.
Right. Okay. We need to take a break. We're on a roll. When we come back, I want to ask you more about the farm crisis of the 80s and how that can inform what we're talking about today. We'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
We're We're back. You're listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio. This is Lisa Held. I'm here with Sienna Chrisman, and we've been talking about the farm crisis. So we talked a lot about what's happening right now. And I think one of the interesting things about the work that you do is that you have a lot of context that informs the interviews that you're doing now. So you're working on a book, is that right, about the 80s farm crisis?
Very slowly, yes.
Okay. So I think where I want to start is, can you just sort of give a little bit of like a background on what the farm crisis of the 1980s was and what it looked like? Because I don't think a lot of people know. And it was a really big moment, right, for our food system. And we're still living a lot of the effects today. So can you just sort of like give us a little cliff notes on what happened?
Yes, I would be glad to. That's the primary thing I like to talk about all the
time.
So I like to go back. So looking at the 1980s, I like to just take one extra step back and look at starting in around the 1960s. There were some really major changes in farm policy, from a system that was more, that was supply management, as I've talked a little about, which guaranteed a price based on farmers' cost of production, which we can kind of think of as a minimum wage.
Okay.
To a system of plant all you can and then get whatever price that you can out on the free market. And then since that price will probably be low because we're planting fence row to fence row, as Earl Butt said, since that price will be low, then the government will make up some of the difference in some kind of subsidy or whatever. And so we can think of that more like food stamps or welfare.
Mm.
And I find it really interesting. I mean, this is really a key point that is very little understood by many people who work on food, certainly, but agriculture as well, is that difference. And so the subsidies that we have now, or the crop insurance, are much more like this food stamps idea. Food stamps are great. I'm a big supporter of food stamps.
Yeah.
But I would rather have a higher minimum wage.
Of course.
For more people. and farmers would rather actually be making up what they're, a real price, a living wage, rather than getting government subsidies to make up the difference of what they're not getting on the free market. So that change really went into effect more or less in the 60s. Earl Butz, Nixon's ag secretary, talked about get big or get out, plant all you can, plant fence row to fence row. And that was very new. So in the 70s then, like I said, there, in agriculture, prices fluctuate. They tend to be low, but sometimes there are times when they are higher. So in the 70s, it happened that for a whole bunch of different reasons, international grain markets were strong, banks were lending really aggressively, farmers were expanding, and there was just a lot of optimism. Prices were really high. And farmers bought a lot of land and a lot of other assets. And in a lot of cases, they were really encouraged to buy their lenders, which included both USDA lenders and bankers. Sometimes farmers would go in to the bank and say, you know, I need an advance. Farming works on credit.
Right.
So they would go in and say, I need a small advance for my seed and my other inputs for the season, which I will then pay back at harvest time. And the banker would say, okay, that's great, but also don't you want an enormous new tractor? And are you thinking about buying that other tract of land that you had your eye on? And the farmer would come out with those things, which was exciting. And then what happened? Again, optimistic farmers, I think.
Well, and they were sort of heeding this call, right? To plant more and plant more.
Exactly. And, exactly. Yeah. It was really this cultural shift of like, we have to be feeding the world. And that's when a lot of that narrative was really starting. Mm. So then, you know, what goes up must come down. Like naturally those high prices did not stay high.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 80s, again, a bunch of different political and economic factors, including the Soviet grain embargo, other foreign grain markets drying up, interest rates skyrocketed, So a bunch of different factors led to really a bottoming out of that economy. Land prices fell, and for a lot of farmers, that meant that assets that they had had on paper one day, the next day were completely different. Like, they had not changed anything, but because of the way that interest rates and land prices were working, rising and falling, mm-hmm. Their assets were completely different, and suddenly they had no assets, and in fact had a lot of debt, and bankers and other lenders started calling in those debts. And so then what was happening was farmers were going in for their loan, for their seed and other inputs, and being told that in fact they couldn't have that, and also all of their debt for that new tractor and that tract of land was now due at the end of the month. And they didn't have that money.
Right.
they had that money on paper maybe 2 years prior, but then they no longer did. So there was this foreclosure crisis that just swept rural America overall, but particularly the Midwest and the Grain Belt and into the Great Plains, some down into Texas, Oklahoma. And it was a lot of consolidation. It led, so the overall outcomes were fewer bigger farms.
Fewer farms overall,
and they were bigger.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Right. You can kind of read that phrase two ways.
Yes, fewer farms that were bigger.
Right.
And then with more farmers leaving farming, some of them would move into town, some of them would move away, but then all of the businesses and community institutions that relied on those farmers just had less base, right. Less economic base, and so a lot of small towns started really drying up and hollowing out, and rural schools closed, rural churches closed, because there were just fewer people there. And so I really point to that period. I wrote a piece right before the 2016 election called If You Want to Understand the Rise of Trump, Head to the Farm, that connected this period of farm crisis to not as the only reason, obviously, for votes for Trump, but just really looking at that rural America has never recovered from that period. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's really interesting now, since the 2016 election, for the last year and a half, like, many people are talking about rural America and, like, what's wrong with rural America and all of that. And people talk about mining and manufacturing and a lot of other factors, and almost nobody talks about the change in the farm economy.
Why is that?
I don't know.
We're trying to change that little by little.
It's weird to me that I am basically, not quite, but almost the only person who's writing about that. Mm. And it's just the base of a lot of how these economies worked.
So visible, even if you just drive through rural America. I mean, you see the towns, you can see the remains of the farms, and I mean, it's just right there in front of you.
Yeah. Right? I think in a lot of ways it really points to the total invisibility of farm policy. Mm. And I mean, this was something that we can get to it at the end, talking about possible solutions. Mm. But some of the people that I interviewed talked about, and other folks that I've, other colleagues have talked about this too, that there is this sense coming out of this whole idea of America must feed the world, America's farmers are feeding the world, the consolidation and growth of farms is just the natural way of the world. There's no other, that is just what happens. Mm-hmm. And that narrative, again, really invisibilizes the fact that there are actually very clear policies behind all of those things. Like, consolidation and farms getting bigger are not natural. It's natural under the current policy that we have.
Right.
But
it's based on a series of decisions.
Yes.
It's not, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there are some people, who are trying to make those policy is visible now, because without them being visible, you can't do anything about them.
Right.
And so that's important. The people who are doing that work are important to me, Because the thing that's really really interesting to me about the 1980s farm crisis is the activism in response to it. Mm. So this crisis was sweeping the Midwest in particular, rural America, and it was a time that there were a lot of right-wing groups that were trying to capitalize on right-wing and like racist anti-Semitic groups that were trying to kind of lure in farmers and say, oh, you know, it's the Jewish banking cabal that's the heart of your problems here. That's why you're losing your farm. You know, it's kind of the same thing as it's the immigrants who are taking your jobs.
Right.
And in response then, in the 80s, there was a very strong, active, grassroots progressive farm movement that formed. And it formed in communities, and then it joined together all across the Midwest, into the Great Plains, into the South. That instead, one of the organizers talked about, there are all these hate groups, and we really want to organize for our communities with love. And they pointed to these policy changes and kind of who was behind those, and that they were really serving major corporations, corporate interests. Mm-hmm. And they talked about, you know, mostly white farmers talked about, it's really bad here, but it's even worse for Black farmers and Latino farmers and Native farmers. They really connected their struggles all across a lot of different lines of difference. They worked with labor unions, with churches, with urban groups, and they really managed to change the narrative in a very significant way about what the problems were and what the solutions were. And in fact, in 1987 or 86. There was
86 or 87, that we'll say.
There was a very progressive farm bill proposal proposed by Senators Harkin and Gebhardt, which would have reestablished supply management as the farm policy. Mm. And that farm bill proposal came extraordinarily close to passage. It did not quite pass, but very close, because of things like the entire Congressional Black Caucus supported it. And that was because of these alliances that the farm movement had made with unlikely allies. Mm. And they had really, these activists had told the story, had changed the narrative in rural communities such that even some of the conservative farm state legislators who might have kind of hated the idea of this progressive farm bill, they had to vote for it because that's what their constituents wanted, and their constituents were telling them that. So that whole period of this very progressive grassroots farmer-based activism, that's not something that we really, that as Americans, we like have space for or know about in the national idea of like, what is rural America? And I get really excited by this, by that idea. And that's not the only time that there's been progressive farmer activism. There's actually a very long history of that. And so the idea of this book is to raise up these stories and look at also like, what can we learn today from that history?
Right. I mean, do you see that as being a possible, like that kind of progressive activism happening now on this issue?
It's really tough. No and yes. it's really tough in large part because of how much rural places have already changed.
Yeah.
That there are just fewer farmers and there are fewer people in those areas. So the organizing base is just much, much smaller. Also the way that, you know, the culture wars have changed a lot of the conversation in rural America, such that it's, you know, so much more about guns and gays than about like a fair price for farmers.
Right.
So actually some pieces about the about churches closing really makes a difference. A lot of small rural churches were really instrumental during this at moving forward some of this farmer advocacy in the 80s. That said, I was really the most exciting thing to me in some of my reporting for this piece were talking to people who were having these conversations. Mm-hmm. This young young woman, Kayla Kalrek, who's running for Kayla Cawther, sorry, who is running for Iowa State House. And she's going around and having kitchen table conversations with people about what matters to you, what does your economy look like, how could it look different. She's trying to uncover, again, the policy solutions, mm-hmm. Or the policy causes of a lot of the problems. And she and others, on the other side of the state, there's a woman, Denise O'Brien, who was really instrumental in the 80s movement. And she is also running for a seat in the Iowa State House. So there are people who are doing this work. And the thing that I always tell urban folks is to seek out candidates like that, or small rural organizations, Missouri Rural Crisis Center, Land Stewardship Project, Federation of Southern Cooperatives are three of my top favorites, and support the work, the grassroots work that is along those lines, that's actually happening in rural places, because it's there. It's there in almost every state, but it just gets really, it gets lost.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because I've been thinking as you talk about this about the activism, the progressive activism that's been kind of springing up more on the liberal side of things right now, right? And these movements that are picking up a little bit of steam. And in a way, it's there is so much that maybe like people could talk to each other about, right? I mean, it's like, you know, asking for policies that will result in people having equal access to resources. Like this is a thing, the same thing that the women's movement is asking for. It's the same thing, the Fight for 15 for minimum wage workers working at a, McDonald's, the farmer isn't making $15 an hour. And right. So there's so many things that actually overlap. And yet there's such a, you know, when you hear the politics, it's like urban, rural, and red and blue, right?
I think that's such an important point. And I mean, that is the kind of work that in the 80s this farm movement was doing. Mm. And that's the work that we need to be doing today, is actually, breaking things down around issues. And some of the family farm organizations that I work with, that's what they do. They organize in rural Missouri around healthcare. And right. You know, and like healthcare is a major need in a lot of rural Missouri.
Yeah.
So, you know, you start a conversation around that, and who knows where it might lead. But like you have those conversations rather than being put off by, oh, I know who that person voted for in 2016. Mm. I think it's that's really exactly it.
Yeah.
That's why I really try to say to urban people, as a Brooklynite myself, that I feel like there is so much, in Brooklyn we dismiss rural voters as all being racist and dumb and voting against their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. And it's way more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And if we're dismissing them, they're also dismissing us for a lot of other reasons.
Right.
But that's not helping anyone. And like, are there ways that we can actually be finding where the pieces of common ground are?
Absolutely.
And given that I kind of sit in the middle of these two places, I feel like, okay, these are the conversations that I'm trying to have and encourage.
Right. We're running out of time and I want to keep talking about this for a lot longer, but before we wrap up, I want to quickly hit the supply management thing again,
because
I feel like we glossed over it. And from everything I read that you've written, that really stood out to me as like, wait, there's this policy solution that I've never heard of that maybe, could really help farmers and rural communities. Can you just, can you just quickly talk about this huge policy issue? Just sort of like what is it? And I mean, why don't we have it anymore?
So it's, again, it's that thing. You can kind of think of it as a minimum wage, rather than food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
The three pieces of it are So it's such a terrible name, supply management.
Yeah.
But the way that I end up always explaining it is that it manages the supply, which somehow like makes it clearer to me. I don't know.
It's like, really strange, but I see right? what you're saying. Yeah.
So it sets a limit on how much farmers can produce, mm-hmm. or anybody. But if we're talking about farming, and it does that, it does that by setting an actual limit.
Okay.
There is a let's call it a grain reserve.
Mm.
And so that's a way that if the limit is exceeded, then the government can buy back extra grain off the market. I will say that China has had grain reserves for maybe 5,000 years. In the Bible, the story of Joseph, that's about grain reserves. This is a thing. Human societies have had grain reserves forever.
Mm.
The U.S. has not had a grain reserve since 1996, which is a little alarming. So the grain reserve is a big piece of it. A floor price for farmers so that their prices never dip below the cost of production. And then conservation is generally also a piece of a supply management program.
Got it.
Because that also takes some land out of production and incentivizes farmers to take care of it well.
Mm-hmm.
So different pieces of that system that we used to have been being chipped away at since the 50s into the 60s, especially, as I said, the last vestiges of it were removed in the 1996 Farm Bill. And instead, we opened up the market, we opened up agriculture to the free market. The really important thing to say about this is that under supply management, the companies who are buying, or whoever it is that is buying the commodity, they have to pay the floor price. Like, they have to pay the going rate.
Okay.
And the government does not really pay anything. In Canada, the dairy supply management, their program, the government is, like, not on the hook for, like, they're not paying a lot for that. So it's the buyers of the commodities in a supply management program that have to pay the prices. Under our current system, the farmers, the prices are, opened up to the free market. The prices are very low. They are not enough to sustain the farmers. And then the government gives them the subsidy or crop insurance or whatever it is. But what that means is that those very low prices, that's now what the companies, the agricultural companies, the grain companies, that's what they are paying.
Right.
So what this all is, and then the government is giving, this taxpayer subsidy. So what our whole current system is really a giant subsidy for agribusiness and for grain traders.
Right.
And they are a very powerful lobby. And they have fought very hard for many years to have this system because it allows them to pay less. It allows them to, it allows us to have a very cheap meat system,
mm-hmm.
Because all of the grain that goes into factory farmed meat is purchased at far below the cost of production. Food may be more expensive, marginally, under a supply management program, but
the people producing it would then not potentially be making a living.
Exactly,
wage,
so. Exactly, and it would also be a very, very different food system,
yeah.
Because like we couldn't have factory farmed meat, like,
right?
That would be insanely expensive.
Wow.
So that's a major piece that really never gets talked about is that our current farm policy is really just a huge giveaway to agribusiness at the expense of farmers and eaters and public health and the environment and animal welfare and basically everything else.
Right. Well, that's sort of a depressing note to end on, but we have to wrap up, unfortunately. No, this has been such an amazing, amazing discussion. Thank you so much for coming. I feel like maybe I have to have you back so we can keep talking about the actual solutions, which we
I would be glad
barely
to.
Got to. Thank you so much, Sienna. And thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.